Gone. I'll come down. Michael and I wait in awkward silence for him to emerge, and my pulse jumps as he ducks through the low front doorway. Seraphine. Hi. He's wearing shorts and a creased grey t-shirt, battered old sneakers. This is only the second time I've seen him this year, and I try to absorb all the details without making it obvious. He looks as though he's considering holding out his hand to shake mine over the gate, but changes his mind and tucks it into his pocket. Not working today? I ask, as if I'm suspicious that he might in fact have a waiting room full of patients upstairs in his grandfather's cottage. Even Michael looks slightly taken aback.
Nope. Got a few days off. I'm giving Grandad a hand while Mum and Dad are away.
His eyes narrow as he studies me, and I shrink in my skin slightly. It strikes me that Edwin has probably asked him to look out for me, has quite possibly told him that I've been behaving erratically. How about you? He asks.
I'm just heading into the doctor's, actually. I've got an appointment.
I wince. Shut up, Seraphine. He doesn't need to know this.
I could give you a lift, he says.
No, no, it's fine. I wanted to walk.
Okay, well, give us a shout if you need anything.
I give a half wave in reply and hurry on. I'm annoyed at myself and at the Harris men. Joel and I are never going to regain our old friendship, but if they didn't insist on calling me names or colluding with my brother to spy on me, we might manage a more comfortable neighbourly relationship. The office's tiny waiting room is empty. Hayley Pickersgill gives me a smile that doesn't reach her eyes, and I keep my chin high as I sweep past her and stand in front of the array of posters on the notice board, each one precisely fixed with brass pins. At the edge of my vision, Hayley waggles her fingers and beams down at a sparkly ring, and I remember Vera mentioning that she was recently engaged to Ralph Luckhurst. The lump in my throat is hard to ignore. There was a time when Ralph used to tell me I was the most beautiful girl in the world. He deserves so much better than Hayley Pickersgill. Pamela calls me through to her room. She's a smiley woman with a kind manner, and I've always liked her, even when she used to give us our dreaded childhood inoculations. She always gave us chocolate buttons afterward.
Seraphine Mays, it does my eyes good to see you. You look just like your dear mamma standing out there in the waiting room. I'm so sorry about your father, my dear. Such a terrible accident. Martin and I came to the service. I don't know if you saw us.
I nod. Thank you for coming. It means a lot. I'm reminded suddenly of one of Michael's old stories. Martin was one of the village bad boys my grandmother took under her wing many years ago after breaking up a fight he was in.
Blood from Martin Lurch's nose dripped all over Mrs. Blackwood's white gloves, Michael used to tell us.
It was such a moving service, Pamela continues. I had a chat with Edwin in the church afterward. Such a fine young man he is. And Danny looked well after his travels. How's your grandmother?
Pamela has always talked a lot and isn't any more discreet about her patients' affairs than she believes she ought to be. I'm thinking this can only help my cause.
Granny Vera's very well, thank you, I say, and she smiles, the skin on either side of her eyes crinkling. So what can I do for you today, my dear? She asks.
I'm after my mother's medical notes. She sits back in surprise.
Whatever for?
I lick my lips.
Her maternity notes, particularly.
I'd like to know whether she had any complications with her pregnancies and births, you know, in case it might be useful to know for my own future. Her gaze flicks to my abdomen. She blinks with professional thoughtfulness, but I can feel the force of her village-centric curiosity behind her eyes. I gesture with my hands palm up. Most women, they can just ask their mums, can't they? I'll never be able to, I say.
She purses her lips.
Of course, my dear, I understand. But I'm afraid it's most unlikely your mother's notes still exist. It was all paper in those days, and they'd have been shredded after. Well, they're destroyed after a patient dies, you see. A year or so afterward, maybe. There's no room to store such things in the long term.
I'm unprepared for her reaching across to pat my hand, and I flinch as she touches me. She draws back. I close my eyes, embracing the swell of disappointment that encourages a tear to spill over and roll down my cheek.
Oh, there, there, my dear.
She scoots her chair closer to mine and passes me a tissue with a practiced flourish from a cardboard cube on her desk, not touching me this time.
Don't get upset. What was it you wanted to know particularly? Maybe I can help?
I dab at my nose. I suppose any scan records from the hospital would have been destroyed by now, too, I ask. She nods, her widened eyes fastened on mine.
Did you know my mother well during her pregnancy with us, with me and Danny?
I ask. She settles back in her seat with a small, satisfied sigh. She'll enjoy repeating all this to Martin tonight, I'm sure. He's a police inspector nowadays, the village bad boy turned good. Between them, Pamela and Martin must see most of the local troubles and catastrophes firsthand.
Ah, I did, my dear. And in her previous pregnancy, too, with Edwin and Theodore. Such beautiful boys. Such a tragedy.
She sighs again, loudly.
She didn't want to see Dr. Mott with her second pregnancy or anyone else. She went off doctors and hospitals for good after little Theo. They told her he might recover, you know, after he fell. Your poor parents sat by his hospital cot for a week before they turned the life support machine off. Terrible it was.
I didn't know that, I whisper. I suspect Edwin doesn't know that either. I wish she hadn't told me. I dig my nails into my palms.
So who did she see with her second pregnancy?
I ask.
Now, let me think. I believe she had a scan at a private hospital in London. She didn't want community midwife visits, I know that, and she was determined to have the baby at home. Well, babies, as it turned out, of course.
She laughs, seemingly undisturbed by the hiccup of strangeness in her story. The hairs on my arms rise. I draw a deep breath in through my nose as unobtrusively as possible.
So, she was expecting just one baby. Well, yes. At least that's what she told people. They'd have forced her to have hospital monitoring if they'd known you were twins, I suppose. And she just wanted to be left alone to have the home birth she wanted. I expect she knew the private hospital wouldn't interfere or wouldn't even know what went on at this end.
I release my breath, my shoulders relaxing. I promised her I'd go over and help with the delivery if she needed me, because she didn't want strangers there. She darts me a sharp look.
I would have gone, but I'd have called for backup, no hesitation. I wouldn't have done anything unprofessional.
I give her my best reassuring smile.
Of course, you two came early in the end,
she continues.
What date was it?
21st of July, I say.
Ah, yes. We weren't expecting you until the end of August, but as it turned out, you did well for twins, getting that close to your due date, and your dear mamma got the home birth she wanted. And did you see us on that day? After...
She goes to pat my hand again, but draws back at the last moment.
Oh, my love. Yes, I did. I dashed up to Summerbourne as soon as I heard the news. Your poor... Poor mother. Dreadful it was. And you so tiny. Well, you were quite a decent size, my dear. But goodness me, your brother was a shrimp of a thing. They sent three ambulances out and fire engines, you know, because of the rocks and everything. And in the end, they took little Danny off to the hospital.
I offered to help, but your father went with Danny, and your grandmother stayed at the house with you and Edwin. A terrible day. I'm listening to her with one part of my brain, but another part is scrabbling around for something. The right question. The key fact. And Laura? I ask. What happened to her? Laura? She says blankly. Then, oh, Laura the nanny? Nice girl. A terrible shock it was to her too, of course. She left. Went off to university, I believe. Edwin loved that girl. Might have helped him if she'd been able to stay on for the summer, but I suppose she couldn't. I nod, exhaling. Another thought occurs to me. Do you remember a man called Alex used to visit my parents? Pamela's face lights up. Oh, I remember him all right. Used to see him around the village a fair bit in those days. He bought the Collisons' old cottage, although he sold it again after your mother died. I remember him coming in here with the nanny once, and your brother. She nudges my arm, and I manage not to react. Ever so handsome he was. Whatever happened to him? I stare at her. I don't know, I say eventually, and she shrugs. Shame. Do you mean he came into the doctor's office here with Laura? Oh, yes. Edwin cut himself and they brought him in, and I put a couple of butterfly stitches on it, if I recall. Nothing major. Such a charming man. Pity he left. Can you remember his surname, Mrs. Larch? I ask. She furrows her brow. An Indian name it was, began with a K. Oh, I can't remember. I can ask Martin for you, if you like. Memory like an elephant, that man. Yes, please, Mrs. Larch, I say, getting to my feet. Yes, please do, and let me know as soon as you can. I'll give you my number. I'm jotting it down and realise she's looking at me with some bemusement. I'm sorry I couldn't help with your mother's notes, my dear, she says, and I wave her apology away. You've been very helpful, honestly. Please do let me know what Martin remembers. I hand her my phone number, and she looks at it, nodding. I feel lighter as I step out of the cool doctor's office into the bright glare of the village high street. My mother had wanted a peaceful home birth without excessive medical interference, so she told people she was expecting just one baby, even though she knew she was having twins. Laura left because she was going to university. Pamela said she was a nice girl. My mother's mental disturbance could hardly have been Laura's fault. Several people greet me as I stroll out of the village, people who have lived within a couple of miles of me virtually my whole life, who have seen me as a baby, a toddler, a schoolgirl in Platts, people who came to my father's funeral the week before last, and probably to my mother's funeral 25 years before that. I wave to Helen and Daisy Luckhurst as they pass me in their car, and then I tilt my face to the sky as I leave the houses behind me, concentrating on the birdsong in the trees and hedges. I will go back to see Laura, I decide. I pull my phone from my pocket as I turn into the lane, and the receptionist who answers my call confirms that Laura will be at her office all day. I'll drive back to London and speak to her face to face this afternoon, and then spend the night at Winterbourne. If I can persuade Laura to tell me the story of my birth, I might finally relax into a proper night's sleep tonight. Back at the house, I'm gathering things for my overnight stay when I notice something odd about my handbag. I didn't take it into the village this morning, so it's next to the microwave where I left it when I arrived home on Thursday night. I know I've taken something out of it since then, the photograph, but the buckle on the flap is done up. I know I wouldn't have done the buckle back up when it was just sitting on the kitchen countertop. My pulse quickens. My phone is in my pocket, but my wallet was in my bag, and I curse our laid-back family habit of leaving doors unlocked and windows open. I fumble to undo the buckle, knowing that Anyone could have gained access to our house via the back doors over the weekend. I line up the contents on the countertop. There isn't much, which is normal. My wallet is here, my driving license, the order of service from Dad's funeral, the letter confirming my compassionate leave from work. Lipstick, hairbrush, spare sunglasses, they're all still here. I stroke my fingertips over each item in turn. But something is missing. Goosebumps rise on my arms. The receipt that hook-nosed man at the neat little house gave me, with Laura's work address scribbled on the back. It was in my bag, wasn't it? I'm almost sure of it. And now it's gone.
8. Laura, September 1991. A subdued atmosphere settled over Summerbourne after Saturday's picnic. Ruth's headache persisted through Sunday, and Dominic went out with the boat-owning neighbour after breakfast and didn't return for several hours. The joint of beef the village butcher had delivered on Friday sat untouched in the fridge, and when Edwin and I grew hungry around midday, we ate cheese sandwiches at the kitchen table. Afterward, we made banana milkshakes laced with honey and drank them out in his den. Clouds loomed ever darker as the afternoon wore on, eventually driving us back indoors. Raindrops spattered against the day nursery windows, and Edwin and I rummaged to find jumpers to pull on. "Summer's over," Ruth muttered as she padded into the kitchen to put the kettle on. Each time I caught sight of Alex's sunglasses on the kitchen windowsill, I remembered the warmth of his skin against mine and the intensity of his gaze and the way his smile lingered when he stopped speaking. How close he must have been to me to have caught me when I stumbled on the cliff steps. I wondered whether he had thought about me at all since the picnic, and then I grew certain that he must see me as a naive, awkward schoolgirl. I had felt so grown up last year, dating a man 6 years older than me. But I didn't want to think about that now, and I knew I should stop thinking about Alex too. I longed to talk to my friends, to giggle with them about ridiculous crushes, and be reminded of our promise that we'd always be there for one another. They'd been there for me when my boyfriend kicked me out of his flat at midnight, and my mum's partner, Beaky, refused to pick me up. They'd been there for me when I was in hospital, when I missed my exams, when I felt like I'd ruined my entire life. But I was living in a different world now, and my friends had moved on too. Even if I'd known their new phone numbers at their new addresses, the prospect of a telephone conversation in the Summerbourne Hall, within earshot of Ruth and Dominic, was unappealing. By the time I got up on Monday morning, Dominic had left for London, and Ruth's headache had disappeared. "Let's walk into the village," she said. "I need stamps. We could get ice creams from the shop, if it doesn't rain." Edwin hopped up and down. "Even if it does rain, Mummy!" "I suppose we could sit under the bus shelter to eat them," she said, smiling. Our luck held, and we savoured our ice cream cones on a bench on the village green in the watery sunshine, sprinkling chocolate crumbs down ourselves and competing to poke the ice cream all the way down to the end of our cornets with our tongues. Two elderly ladies stopped to greet Ruth and made reference to Theo. Edwin remained unruffled while Ruth thanked them for their concern. I wanted to ask her whether Theo was buried in the churchyard beyond the green, but bit my tongue. Ruth's praise of my discretion lingered in my memory. The threat of autumn receded as the week wore on. I swam in the pool with Edwin and Joel, and Michael taught us the Norfolk words for creepy crawlies. "Charlie Pig, Airy Wiggle, Bishy Barney Bee," the boys chanted. Edwin had a particular throaty chuckle that I only ever heard when he was around Joel. When they grew tired of playing outside, we made dragons out of Play-Doh or drew pirate maps, which Edwin stashed in his treasure box. Ruth took Edwin to gymnastics on the Wednesday, and I made a respectable start on my chemistry studying. The calendar in the kitchen showed R, reflexology, 10 a.m. for Friday. Particularly intriguing, since most of the boxes for the month were blank. When I flipped back through the year, there was a similar note once or twice each month. Ruth didn't refer to it at breakfast, but when Edwin and I were gathering containers to go foraging for blackberries, she told us she was popping out. "I'll be back for lunch. Do you want me to pick you anything up in town?" she asked. "No thanks, I'm fine," I said. The phone in the hall rang just after she'd left. I peered through the window. She was in her car, pulling the sun visor down and rummaging through her bag on the passenger seat. I picked up the receiver. "Hello, Summerborn?"
"Hi, Laura, it's Alex. How are you?"
The receiver slipped in my hand and I fumbled to bring it back to my ear. "Hi, I'm fine, thanks."
"Glad to hear it. Is Ruth there?"
I checked. The car was gliding out of the drive. "She's just gone out," I said.
"Oh, do you know when she'll be back? I wanted to drop something round. I'm at the cottage, but I've got to stay in this afternoon for the electrician."
"She won't be long, but I'm here if you want to come now. If you want to leave it here for her, I mean."
Okay. I might do that, actually. Thanks, Laura. I'll see you in a bit."
He hung up. Edwin stood in front of me, one sandal on, a bucket in his hand.
"Who's coming?"
"That was Uncle Alex. He wants to bring something round for your mummy." Edwin beamed.
"I'll show him my crocodile pictures."
He lolloped away to the day nursery to find them. I stood in the hall a moment longer, studying my flushed cheeks in the mirror. I resisted attempting to tidy my hair and went through to the kitchen to boil the kettle, drumming my fingers on the countertop while I waited. It was another 40 minutes before Alex arrived, by which time Edwin had grown bored and gone to play in his sandpit. He must have heard the crunch of wheels on gravel, though, as he came tearing through the house when Alex's car pulled up.
"Whoa there, you get stronger every day, young man," Alex said.
Edwin bounced up and down as Alex opened the sports car's little trunk.
"Sorry, nothing for you today, my friend. This is for your beautiful mama."
He lifted out a bouquet of luscious pink roses, tweaking a few to disguise the flattening from their journey. "They're lovely," I said, my hands feeling suddenly awkward at my sides.
"Just to thank her for the picnic. It's really nice of you to let me drop them off. Can I put them in the kitchen?"
He hesitated, and I remembered that I was the responsible adult of the house and gestured for him to follow me in.
"We're going to pick blackberries, but we waited for you, Uncle Alex," Edwin said, and I frowned.
"Oh, that was very kind of you,"
Alex said.
"And where has your mother gone?"
Edwin shrugged elaborately.
"To see the quacks, most probably."
Alex raised his eyebrows at me. I mimicked Edwin's shrug. "Reflexology?" I felt a flicker of disloyalty to Ruth after her comment about me being discreet. But surely she wouldn't mind me telling Alex. Alex laughed.
"Is that what your daddy calls them?"
he said to Edwin.
"Are you coming with us then?" Edwin asked him. "To pick blackberries?"
He swung one leg as he looked from Alex's face to mine. Alex checked his watch.
"Where are you going? To the Folly?"
I nodded. I was acutely aware of his sunglasses on the windowsill, that I ought to give them back to him. But I held my breath, waiting, willing him to come with us.
"How about I come for a bit?"
he said, directing the question at Edwin, but glancing at me to check. I released my breath and smiled.
"Sure," I said,
and Edwin cheered and ran to fetch his bucket. I grabbed keys, but hesitated.
"Shall I lock up, or will you need to get through to your car if you come back first?"
He chuckled.
I see we feel the same way. These country folk leaving their houses unlocked all the time. It's unsettling. No, don't worry. You lock up, and if I come back before you, I can always jump the wall by the stables."
I turned the keys with a smile. We felt the same way.
"So how long are you here for?"
he asked as we set off down the garden.
"Oh, pairing, I mean. Is it a long-term thing?"
"For a year," I said. I watched Edwin skip toward the trees ahead of us. I missed my A-levels. I was in hospital. I decided it'd be good to take a year out before retaking them.
Not retaking, exactly, is it? If you didn't get to sit them in the first place.
No, well, I pushed away the memory of turning up at the first exam against doctor's orders, stumbling out again before the proctor could tell me to turn over my paper. Alex filled his lungs and gestured at the vibrant garden around us, the cloudless sky.
Well, you certainly picked a great place for a year out. I wish I'd stepped off the conveyor belt for a year at your age. It's all exams, interviews, work, work.
I glanced at his expression, hesitating to ask him what it was he did for work. But a whoop from Edwin as he disappeared into the little woods made Alex grin suddenly.
I might take a year off myself, actually. I think I'd make a pretty good au pair. What do you do all day? Pick blackberries? Play on the beach? Easy stuff.
Hey! I shook my head, but I couldn't help laughing. He asked me about my university plans then, and he gave me his full attention, while I told him about my passion for science and my desire to one day run my own research lab. His gaze remained on my face, rather than on the path ahead. I felt as though I walked taller, and my limbs moved more gracefully, as if he had high expectations of me, and I was rising to meet them. A piercing scream burst the illusion. My chest constricted. We sprinted through the last section of woodland and found Edwin lying on the ground by the gate, one side of his face streaked with blood. Let me look, let me look, I said, trying to keep his head still as he thrashed around in Alex's arms.
I fell off!
Edwin wailed. His blood made my hands slippery. We'll have to get him back to the house. I can't see. Alex carried Edwin back at a gentle jog, and by the time we had him sitting up on the kitchen table, he was hiccuping between sobs and managed to keep still enough to be cleaned up. There was a 1 centimeter gash near the top of his right ear. So much blood from such a tiny wound. Alex and I looked at each other over the top of his head. I think I'd better take him to the doctor, I said. He might need stitches.
I'll drive you down there,
he said. But there's no room in your car.
It'll take 2 minutes. He can sit on your knee.
The receptionist, when we walked in, was displeased, but the nurse who called us through couldn't have been kinder. She cleaned the wound and closed it with tiny strips of sticking plaster and gave Edwin a lollipop and a sticker for his bravery.
Can I have one too?
Alex asked, and she actually nudged his chest as she chuckled at him. I gritted my teeth. We sat for a few minutes on the bench on the village green, giving Edwin time to finish his lollipop. Alex stretched his arm along the back of the bench, behind Edwin's head, and if I'd leaned in a tiny bit, his fingertips would have touched my bare shoulder. Helen, Ruth's pregnant friend, waddled past and smiled at us. Alex ruffled Edwin's hair and then grimaced at me over his head. You okay? I asked.
I'm just so relieved it wasn't any worse,
he said. I nodded. A screech of brakes on the high street made us both turn to look, and my heart jolted at the sight of Ruth sprinting across the grass toward us, her car door gaping open behind. A van tooted. Alex stood up. My God, what happened? She dropped to her knees in front of Edwin, who pulled his shrunken lollipop out of his mouth with a pop and giggled at the sound. She looked from Alex to me and back to Alex.
What happened?
She asked again, and her voice had dropped an octave, the consonants exaggerated in a way that made my skin tingle.
He tried to climb the gate, and he slipped. Alex said, we were going to pick some blackberries.
He pulled Ruth upright to face him, placed a hand on her shoulder, and then put his other hand gently on her cheek.
He's fine, Ruth. It was a little cut, but the nurse cleaned it up, and he's completely fine.
She twisted away from him and dropped back down in front of Edwin. Tell me what happened, darling.
Mrs. Pamela Larch gave me a lolly, Edwin answered,
waving it at her and then poking it back in. Before that, Edwin, how did you hurt yourself? Alex and I exchanged a glance. His forehead was crumpled, and I wanted to squeeze his hand and say, it wasn't our fault. Edwin swung his legs back and forth, avoiding his mother's eyes.
I fell off the gate, Mummy. I was just trying to climb it. It had the bolt on.
It's supposed to have the bolt on, darling, to keep you safe. She stood up again, without looking at either of us. We're going home, Edwin. Put your stick in the bin, please.
Ruth,
Alex said, but she shook off his hand. He's all I have left, Alex, she hissed, as Edwin skipped over to the trash bin and then sauntered back to take her hand. They set off toward her car. I looked from Alex to the retreating figure of my employer.
Go,
he said. I jogged after them. While Ruth fastened Edwin into his car seat on one side, I went round and eased myself into the back seat from the other side. She didn't comment and didn't speak to either of us on the short drive home. Something held me back from apologizing as we entered the hall, but I touched her gently on her arm. Why don't you go and sit down, and I'll bring you a cup of tea? I said. After a moment's pause, her shoulders sagged, and she met my eyes briefly. Okay, she said. Come on, darling, let's see what's on the TV and have a cuddle. She led Edwin off to the sitting room. I hurried into the kitchen and scooped the wads of blood-stained kitchen paper from the table, bundling them into a carrier bag, which I stuffed underneath the top layer of rubbish in the bin. Then I dashed through to the annex and changed into a clean t-shirt, leaving my blood-stained top soaking in cold water in my bathroom sink. I returned to the kitchen just as the kettle finished boiling, and I picked the dried blood from under my fingernails while the tea brewed in the pot.
9. Seraphine. I'm parked outside Laura's office again, preparing to ring her, to ask her to come down and meet me. Across the pavement and through the glass doors, I can see the receptionist stapling sheets of paper together. A young woman who looks like she might still be a teenager collects a pile of letters from the desk and disappears into the elevator. My phone vibrates, and an unknown number flashes up. The words, Dear Seraphine, Martin says that man, make me smile, as I picture Pamela nipping home on her lunch break and collaring her elephant-memoried husband. She's a kind woman. Dear Seraphine, Martin says that man's name was Alex J. Kaimal. Lived in Leeds. He sold the Collinsons' cottage about a year after your mother, R.I.P., passed away. Young Billy Bradshaw handled the sale. Martin spoke to Alex on the phone after the accident, but he had nothing to add to the investigation. Warmest regards, Pamela Larch. I send a quick response. Mrs. Larch, thank you so much. I really appreciate your help, Seraphine. Then I type Alex J. Kaimal Leeds into my web browser. There's a senior executive for an engineering company in Leeds with that name. He's also associated with a private company registered in India, a running club in Roundhay, and as a donor at a charity ball for diabetes research. I can't find a Facebook account for him, but I tap on a thumbnail picture on the engineering company website, and an image of a middle-aged man in a jacket and tie springs up. He is broad-shouldered, with a blend of Asian and Caucasian features. His skin a mid-brown, his hair dark. His posture exudes confidence, and his serious expression is warmed by the hint of a smile around his eyes. If he was the same age as my parents, he'd be in his mid-50s now. But he looks younger here, no trace of grey in his short hair. Perhaps it's an old photo, or perhaps he's lucky, or perhaps he's vain. I think of Pamela saying, ever so handsome, and even on my little screen, I see that he might possess a certain charisma. I scrutinize his face. Who are you, Alex Kaimal? What was your relationship with Laura? Why did you disappear after my mother died? I sigh and tap away, calling the insurance company in front of me before I can change my mind. The phone rings twice.
Good afternoon. Crowford Insurance. How may I help?
I'd like to speak to Laura Silveira, please, I say.
One moment, I'm putting you through.
The ringtone sounds 6 times. 7. 8. No answer. The receptionist comes back on the line after the 9th ring.
I'm so sorry. Miss Silveira doesn't appear to be at her desk at the moment. Would you like me to try someone else?
I curl forward, bumping my forehead against the steering wheel. But I rang this morning. I struggled to keep my tone calm.
You told me. Was it you I spoke to? You told me she'd be here all day.
I keep my gaze fixed on my knees, not wanting to look across and catch her smiling, although when she speaks again, I can hear it in her voice.
She may have gone out to an external meeting. Perhaps you could try again later.
I hang up. If she's gone out to a meeting, she might not come back to the office. But what if she's still in the building? What if she's avoiding answering her phone after she was lured down for a non-existent delivery last week? My forehead leaves a damp patch on the steering wheel when I sit up. I call Edwin's number, but he doesn't answer, busy at work. I call the Winterbourne landline in case Danny is hanging out there today. He's been cagey about his plans since he got back from working in Kenya last month, shrugging off questions even before Dad's accident. My twin brother is still looking for his place in life, in a different way to me. I hang up when the Winterbourne answer machine kicks in, and I try Danny's mobile, but again, no answer. My thumb hovers over Vera's number, but I flick past and in the end choose to send Edwin a text. Can I stay with you tonight? Unlike Summerbourne, Winterbourne House is protected with sophisticated locks and a burglar alarm, but I have my own key and I know the code. I'm asking out of politeness. A reflected glint from the sliding glass doors catches my eye, and it takes me a full second to register that the tall figure striding down the steps in front of me is Laura. It's mid-afternoon, and she has no bag with her, just a white envelope clutched in one hand. She turns sharply to the left, knocking shoulders with a burly man in a suit as she passes, causing him to mutter something crossly to her back. I shove my phone into my trouser pocket and leap out of the car, dodging around other pedestrians to keep her hunched figure within sight as far as the park gate where she turns in. I sprint ahead, sweat soaking into my top. I can't lose her again. When I swing through the gate, I spot her instantly, veering away from the main path, hurrying over toward the empty bandstand. I jog along the inner line of the boundary hedge, not following her directly, but closing the gap between us. As she reaches the bandstand, she skirts its perimeter and approaches a bench and a trash bin. I keep my face turned away toward the hedge as I jog past, but there are some trees up ahead, and when I reach them, I circle around to get as close to her as I can without being seen. She doesn't sit on the bench. She tears the envelope open, and her hands are shaking. She tugs out a folded sheet of paper, opens it, and looks at it for a few seconds, and then she turns to bend over, one outstretched arm supported by the top of the trash bin, and she vomits onto the ground. I draw a deep breath in, my stomach clenching. What on earth is this? Has she brought this letter out of the office to open away from prying eyes? What does it say? I creep forward in the undergrowth to get a better view. She's wiping her mouth on the back of her hand now, and she takes the sheet of paper in its refolded state and rips it in half and half again and again. She scrunches the pieces up and shoves them into the trash bin. Then she does the same with the envelope. She straightens and looks around not directly toward me, and then she pats the pocket of her trousers and sets off toward the main path that bisects the park. I wait until she's on the path, heading for the far end of the green, before I emerge from my hiding place and start to follow her. There are family groups playing football and frisbee and others sitting around on the grass. I concentrate on keeping Laura in sight, getting steadily closer as she leaves through a gate on the far side. I follow her along residential streets, crossing over once, turning right at the next junction. These are narrow roads with cars parked all the way along each side, and I'm expecting her to notice me at any moment. But she tugs keys out of her pocket as she swings jerkily into the front garden of a narrow end of terrace house, ignoring the broad steps up to the front door and instead disappearing down the side alley toward the door of the basement flat. "Excuse me!" I shout, and I dive through the gate and around the corner of the building. Laura is frozen in position, her hand on the key in the lock, her head turned toward me. I stop with a jolt, and we look at each other for a long moment. She's breathing through her mouth, and there's a sheen of sweat on her face. "I'm Seraphine Mays," I say. "I know who you are." Her tone is flat, but her hand trembles as she turns the key and starts to push her front door open, keeping her eyes on me. "I was hoping I could ask you some questions," I say, stepping forward as she eases herself through the door, rotating her body so that she's still facing me, but is now inside her flat.
"I can't help you, Seraphine. Please go away."
She starts to close the door, to shut me out, but I put my hand against it, pushing lightly, and she hesitates.
"Please," I say. "I just want to ask you about Summerborn."
She presses her lips together and shakes her head slightly. I search her face. It must have been traumatic for her, my mother dying the way she did. But still, 25 years on, shouldn't she be happy to meet me? One of the babies she helped deliver?
"You were there when we were born?" I ask. "Danny and I?"
She turns her face further into the shadows of the dark hallway, and I have to increase my push against the door to counteract hers. If she puts her whole weight behind it, I won't be able to stop her closing it against me, and I desperately try to find words to stall her.
"The photo," I say. "Did you take it? On the patio, with only one of us in it?"
Her eyes widen, and I can see that they're brown, like mine, not blue, like my brother's. She twitches the door away from me, and I lurch sideways, unbalanced, knowing any second now she's going to slam it, and any chance I have of hearing the truth will be over. I blurt out the question before I can change my mind.
"Are you my mother?"
And suddenly, her face softens, and I read sympathy in her eyes as her grip on the door relaxes and she exhales heavily. I press my lips together, trying to calm my breathing so that I can concentrate on every detail of her reply.
"No, I'm not your mother, Seraphine." "How funny you'd think that."
She pauses and I watch the flicker of expressions on her face.
"I was with your mother when you were born."
She still blocks the doorway, but she reaches out with her free hand and touches me gently on my forearm. I hold my breath.
"Your mother said you were the most beautiful baby she had ever seen, like an angel."
I am aware of tears on my cheeks, but I focus harder than ever on her face, on her fleeting, sad smile as she mentions my mother, on the steadiness of her gaze as she says these precious words, words I've been waiting my whole life to hear, words I should have been able to turn over and examine every day of my life until they were as smooth as glass pebbles from the sea. Instead,
I am lacerated by the glittering surprise of them as I clutch them to me now. She opens the door a tiny bit, and I remove my hand from it and take a small step back.
I can't talk to you anymore, Seraphine, she says. I'm sorry about your father. I only just heard. Please don't come here again.
The door bangs shut in my face, and I hear the grate of locking mechanisms on the inside. I wander back out to the pavement, dazed. At some point on her road, I stop to lean against somebody's gatepost, taking deep breaths and trying to clear my head. Eventually, I have the presence of mind to go back and make a note of her house number and then the street name. I feel empty as I retrace my steps to the park. I came for an explanation, a resolution, but I'm leaving with a sense that Laura was protecting secrets in that dark hall, pushing them into the shadows behind her to keep them from my view. Just inside the park gate, a child drops a popsicle stick on the path in front of me, and suddenly, my swelling resentment is punctured by the thrill of an idea. I jog over to the trash bin by the bandstand, keeping my feet clear of the mess on the ground as I reach my hand tentatively through the slot on one side, feeling for scrunched up paper. I'm lucky. I pull out several wadded sections, slightly damp, keeping my face turned away from the smell. On my last attempt to feel for more, the drone of a wasp rises from the mass of rubbish and I withdraw my arm sharply. I hold the pieces of paper away from my body and a solitary child watches me with his mouth open as I hurry toward the gate. Back in my car, I quickly abandon an attempt to piece together the shreds of the letter and check my phone to find a reply from Edwin saying, "Course you can. I'll be home around 8. Winterbourne is the opposite to Summerbourne in many ways. It's formal on the outside and sparsely furnished on the inside, with none of the clutter that our childhood country home has accumulated over generations. Nevertheless, it has a welcoming calmness that always soothes me as soon as I step inside. When Edwin moved in 4 years ago, he replaced the old gas burners in the kitchen with a sleek induction cooktop, but changed little else. Danny is staying here at the moment, but I've no idea where he goes during the day. His motorbike is parked undercover to the side of the house, but when I call his name from the entrance hall, there's no reply. I place my handbag on the polished wood of the dining table and begin to peel the layers of damp paper apart and lay them out. The words are machine printed and form a narrow band across the middle of the page. There's a section missing, but it belongs to the upper right corner of the paper, and I imagine would have been just blank space anyway. I hold my breath as I look at the two sentences I have recreated, and then a surge of nausea makes me dash to the cloakroom. The stench from the park trash bin still clings to my hands, and I scrub repeatedly with antibacterial hand wash. I need a hot shower and clean clothes. I creep back into the dining room and read the note again. Dominic Mays is dead. If you discuss Summerbourne with anyone, your daughter will be next. I leave the room and close the door softly behind me. My mother said I looked like an angel when I was born. I remind myself, the most beautiful baby she had ever seen. I won't think about the letter until Edwin gets home. An hour later, I'm heading downstairs in fresh clothes, running my hands along the smooth oak banister, stroking the heavy brocade curtains as I pass them on the landing. As I make the last turn on the staircase, a complete stranger, a slim young woman with long white blonde hair, steps out of the cloakroom, sees me and screams.
Danny appears in the kitchen doorway, a tea towel over one shoulder.
Brooke?
He turns to gaze up at me and then pads across to her with an apologetic grimace.
I'm so sorry. Meet my sister, Seraphine.
She is pretty scary, I know.
I had no idea she was here, actually.
He shoots me a dark look. Seraphine, this is Brooke from next door. I come down two steps. Hi.
Hi.
Her eyes are pale blue like a washed-out sky, and she doesn't smile.
Did the grumpy couple move out then?
I ask Danny. He closes his eyes.
No,
Brooke says.
I'm their daughter.
Oh, God, I'm so sorry.
What are you doing here, Seth?
Danny asks me, his tone cool.
Does Edwin know you've come?
Of course he does.
I take another step down, glancing at Brooke and back to Danny.
I need to talk to you, actually.
Brooke directs her gaze toward the grandfather clock, rather than at either of us.
Well, Brooke's here for dinner, Danny says. I invited her.
I carve my thumbnail into the wax on the banister. I wonder whether this is the first time Danny has invited this woman for dinner. He never mentioned her name in all the days he stayed at Summerbourne before and after Dad's funeral. I wonder how well they know each other, and how she'll react to sharing the dining table with a threatening letter that smells like the contents of a warm park trash bin.
I went to see Laura today, I say.
Danny stares at me.
She's being threatened.
Brooke looks at me directly then. I'm expecting a hint of annoyance, but her expression is strangely serene. She glides over to Danny and kisses him lightly on the cheek, and then picks up a bunch of keys from the hall table.
We can do dinner some other time, she tells him,
and then switches her calm gaze to me.
It's nice to meet you, Seraphine. I'm sorry about your father. I'll let myself out.
She leaves without glancing back.
Danny glares at me and then stalks off into the kitchen where he crashes pans around on the cooktop.
I follow and sink down on a kitchen chair, rubbing my eyes.
This had better be good, he says eventually. I'll tell you when Edwin gets here.
He keeps his back to me for a while, but eventually says,
I miss him too, you know.
Oh, Danny.
He turns and I stretch my arms out toward him.
I know.
When Edwin arrives, he finds us holding hands at the kitchen table, a mound of tissues between us, our faces streaked with tears. Edwin bends to hug me, pats Danny on the back, and then leaps to rescue the stew which is starting to burn at the base of the pan. I confess everything to my brothers over dinner, following Laura to the park, watching her read the letter and throw up, confronting her on her doorstep, what she said about our mother. We sit around one end of the dining table picking at our food, while the pieced-together letter lurks at the other end like an uninvited guest. I'm feeling increasingly uncomfortable with the route the conversation is taking.
We should go to the police, Edwin says. Whatever this is about, we should report it.
Oh, and what will I say?
I ask him.
I stalked this woman. I pulled a ripped-up note out of a trash bin in the park and stuck it together.
I try to imagine pressing the soggy, taped-together letter into Martin Larch's large hands.
I'm worried, Seraphine,
Edwin says. It mentions Dad and Summerbourne. Going to Laura's house today, you might have put yourself in danger. I shove my plate away.
I'm not her daughter.
I know, I know.
He takes my hand, squeezes it.
I didn't mean it like that, just that you were there, asking questions about Summerbourne.
Plus, the small fact, Danny says quietly, that whoever wrote this seems to be implying they caused Dad's death. Edwin and I stare at him,
and then our eyes are drawn back to the note.
That's one interpretation,
Edwin says eventually. A hollow threat, I say.
Yeah, using Dad's accident to try to frighten her,
Edwin says.
Because we know it was an accident, I say. Don't we?
Danny turns his stew over and over with his fork. The air in the dining room seems to squeeze inward and then recede, as if Winterbourne itself is listening, considering.
Of course, Danny says. We know that.
Edwin sits back.
Well then, I say. All this tells us is Laura knows something about Summerbourne and someone wants to stop her talking about it.
Edwin groans.
But not necessarily anything to do with us. Who knows what happened that year? It might be something to do with a friend, a boyfriend. Nothing to do with our family, just something that happened while she was living in our house.
So why mention Dad then? Danny asks.
Exactly, I say. She knows something about us.
Edwin gives me a sharp look.
No. If you won't go to the police, then you have to drop this, Seraphine. I mean it. You mustn't approach Laura again.
I grind my teeth and glance at Danny for backup, but Danny looks just as concerned as Edwin.
I agree,
Danny says.
She told you herself to stay away from her. You've got to drop it, sis. Promise.
I close my eyes and think about my father. Dominic Mays is dead. And my mother. Your mother said you were the most beautiful baby she had ever seen. When I blink them open, both my brothers are watching me with a familiar wariness. I sigh. I won't approach Laura again, I promise. I stand and grab my plate. I'm shattered. Thanks for dinner. And Danny, I scrunch up my face. I'm sorry about spoiling your plans with Brooke. I'm going to bed. I scrape my uneaten stew into the waste disposal sink and slide my plate into the dishwasher before making my way up to the bedroom I always use at Winterbourne. Something continues to niggle at me. The stolen scrap of paper with Laura's work address. The threatening letter sent to Laura's work address is the same person responsible for both? The weight of the bedspread on my body comforts me despite the heat of the evening, and my breathing deepens and slows as I gaze at the faint cracks in the ceiling, familiar from my childhood stays here. I promised my brothers I wouldn't approach Laura again. A moth batters at the bedside lamp, and I reach out for the switch, but my fingers rest on my phone, and before I turn out the light, I do a quick internet search to find out how long it will take me to drive up to Leeds tomorrow. I promised my brothers I wouldn't approach Laura again, but I didn't say anything about Alex Kaimal.
10. Laura. September to October 1991. It wasn't my fault. I tidied toys and washed dishes while Ruth got Edwin ready for bed that evening. Each time I heard a noise that might have been Dominic's car approaching along the lane, my stomach lurched. It wasn't our fault. But if I hadn't let Edwin run ahead out of sight, if I hadn't been so wrapped up in Alex's company... It was an accident. Dominic would understand that. I checked my watch again, and a familiar gravel crunch reached my ears. Daddy! Edwin bounded down the stairs in his pajamas, launching himself into Dominic's arms. From the kitchen doorway, I could barely make out the crust of blood that edged the plaster strips.
What's all this?
I cut it on the gate, Daddy. I got a lollipop. Ruth leaned against the wall a few steps up from the bottom, her arms crossed. Laura will tell you, she said. Dominic looked from her to me. He tried to climb the gate. We were right behind him. He must have slipped. It's actually only a little cut.
There was blood everywhere, Edwin said.
Dominic kissed the top of his head and set him down. He forced a smile as he stroked Edwin's cheek.
What sort of lollipop did you get?
A round one, you know, a red one.
Strawberry?
Edwin shrugged.
Well, don't climb the gate again, Edwin. It's not a good idea. Come on, let's get you back into bed. I'll read you a story tonight.
Dominic squeezed Ruth's arm briefly as he passed her on the stairs, and she closed her eyes. I retreated to the annex and went straight to bed, listening to the rain on the window for hours, failing to sink into sleep. Edwin and I ate breakfast together the next morning before slipping outside to potter around by the climbing frame. I rubbed my arms while he practiced shooting down the slide head first. The grass underfoot was slippery, and a faint hint of bonfire smoke mingled with the earthy scent from the damp borders. Dominic joined us, his slippers stained dark with dew, his hands wrapped around a mug of coffee. He stood next to me, and we watched Edwin in silence for a while.
I'm sorry if Ruth upset you yesterday,
he said eventually. I shook my head. No, not at all. I understand.
She's feeling particularly fragile at the moment.
She didn't upset me. I feel terrible about frightening her like that. It must be very hard after what happened with your other son. A spasm distorted his face for a moment, and I looked away. He blew out a loud puff of air.
It's not just that. She's been hoping. We've been hoping for some happier news recently. A new brother or sister for Edwin. But sadly...
He cleared his throat.
Daddy, help me on the monkey bars,
Edwin called. Dominic handed me his coffee mug and leaped to Edwin's aid. Any anticipation of comfort evaporated as I discovered the liquid inside was stone cold. Vera joined us at Summerbourne the following day. Dominic was preparing a joint of pork and making applesauce, and Ruth felt too unwell to collect her from the station, so she arrived in a taxi.
Perhaps we should arrange some driving lessons for you, Laura, while you're here,
Vera said, checking her hair in the hall mirror. In the sitting room doorway, Ruth rolled her eyes. I smoothed down a spike of hair on Edwin's head, wary of replying.
Perhaps we should arrange some driving lessons for you, Mother, Ruth said.
Vera waved a hand dismissively.
Oh, I'm too old for such things.
You're not even 50. But don't worry about it. Everyone loves driving you places, don't they? It's a real treat for us. Vera ignored her.
Now, Edwin, what have you been painting this week? You must show me everything.
If anything, Edwin's injury looked more dramatic than it had on the first day, with a thick scab bulging from the contour of his ear. Vera didn't mention it in front of him, though, and I guessed that either Ruth or Dominic had told her about it over the phone. Once Edwin had shown off his latest pictures and models, he settled at the day nursery table to paint a new scene. Vera beckoned me to the other end of the room. How are you getting on? She asked. With the job? With everything? Oh, fine, I said. Great, thank you. She gave me an appraising look.
Are they working you too hard? You shouldn't be working today at all. 22 hours a week, isn't it?
I spread my hands, indicating the day nursery and the little boy who sat dipping his brush into paint with his tongue poking out. Honestly, it doesn't feel like work. I'm happy being with Edwin when I'm off duty, and it hardly feels like work when I'm on duty. She scrutinized my face.
You're not homesick? Stuck out here in the middle of nowhere?
She asked. I shook my head.
You're not bored? Missing your friends?
She asked. I'm okay. Really?
Well, nevertheless, I shall remind my daughter not to take advantage of your good nature.
She sighed.
And how would you say Ruth has been?
Edwin's little accident gave her a shock, of course. I was saved from replying by Dominic calling us through to the dining room for lunch. I didn't talk to Ruth properly until the Monday, when Dominic and Vera had returned to London, and she and I were sitting in the kitchen, trying to ignore the grey drizzle outside and planning our activities for the week. "My mother says I'm not to overwork you," she said, looking at me sideways. I smiled. "Well, you haven't so far, and I promise to tell you if you do," I said, and she seemed satisfied with this. She pushed a leaflet across the table to me. "There's some kind of indoor play centre opened up, look," she said. "I thought I'd take Edwin along this afternoon and see what it's like. Let him burn off some energy. They do coffee and cakes." She paused for a moment. "You might prefer to stay here and have some downtime, or study or whatever, but..." She looked at me. "If you fancy coming along to try the coffee with me, I'd be glad of the company." A warm glow spread through my chest. "I'd love to come." As it turned out, the place was dimly lit and overheated, and we had to talk over the noise of wailing babies and shrieking children. But Edwin thoroughly enjoyed the padded climbing structure with its slides and ball pool, and Ruth and I chatted for an hour and a half as if we were friends. The miserable weather persisted for the rest of the week, but Edwin and I were happy enough dividing our time between the day nursery and the kitchen. "My mum used to do lots of baking with me when I was your age," I told him. "Did she let you do the whisking all by your own?" I smiled. "No, she always had to hold it too. But you can press the button if you like." His little hands gripped the electric whisk under mine, his elbows jutting out on either side, a fierce determination on his face. The clatter of the metal beaters against the sides of the bowl triggered an unexpected swell of emotion in me. Nostalgia, mixed with a powerless anger. Mum and I used to do this all the time before Beaky moved in. Beaky didn't like mess in the kitchen. Beaky didn't like children traipsing around to the neighbours with cakes they'll only throw in the trash. I left enough mixture in the bowl for Edwin to scrape out and enjoy while the cakes rose in their tins in the oven. We pulled on coats and wellies on the Friday and splashed along the lane to see whether Joel was in the cottage with Michael. But no one answered the door, and we had to splash home again. On the Saturday, I agreed to babysit so that Dominic and Ruth could go out for dinner. They left their bedroom door ajar, and I couldn't help but glance in after I'd settled Edwin to sleep. There was a single framed photo on the chest of drawers by the window. I tiptoed in. Two blonde toddlers in stripy t-shirts, each with an arm over the other's shoulder. The one that looked more like Edwin, grinning at the camera, the other sticking his bottom lip out. It must have been taken not long before Theo's accident, I thought. Ruth and Dominic must look at it every morning when they wake up, every evening as they go to bed. It was the following Monday morning, after Dominic had left, that Alex rang. "Oh, hello, Alex," I heard Ruth say as she answered the phone. I hovered in the kitchen, where Edwin was finishing his Weetabix cereal. "This Friday?" I heard her say. "I might be." I glanced at the calendar. The square for Friday was blank. "Yes, all right." A pause, and then she gave a light laugh. "Absolutely. So easy. Come over when you're ready." I put the kettle back on to boil as she wandered in. "Tea?" I asked. "Oh, yes, please. That was Alex. He wants to take me out for lunch on Friday." She bent to drop a kiss onto Edwin's head. I attempted a smile, but she shook her head suddenly. "I don't know why he thinks I'm at his beck and call. Just because we're out in the country doesn't mean we don't have plenty of other things going on in our lives." She stroked Edwin's hair, frowning. "I might have to keep you this size forever and ever, Edwin," she murmured. I gritted my teeth. At the picnic on the beach a couple of weeks ago, she was begging Alex to visit her during the week, to rescue her from boredom. Now she was complaining about him. Edwin batted her hand away and jumped up to take his bowl to the sink. Alex wasn't mentioned again until the Friday morning, and it was me who brought him up when I saw Ruth checking her lipstick in the hall mirror and unhooking her raincoat from the cupboard. "I'm just popping out," she told me. "Helen Luckhurst had her baby on Monday, a little girl. They think she has some problems. I'm going to take her some flowers, see if we can do anything to help." I stared at her. "Isn't Alex taking you out for lunch?" She laughed and waved the question away. "Oh, Alex, I'd almost forgotten. Well, he can jolly well wait for me to get back. I'll only be an hour or so," she said, and she picked up her bag and marched out of the house. I watched her car glide out of the drive, pausing alongside two figures for a minute as she wound down her window and said something before disappearing toward the village. Michael and Joel ambled up the gravel, and I had the door open before they reached it. "Please may I play with Edwin?" Joel asked, craning his neck to peer behind me into the house.
"Preschool's closed,"
Michael said to me with a wiggle of his eyebrows.
"He was coming with me to the Matthews place, but Ruth said you might not mind having him here for a bit instead. Don't want to impose."
I swung the door open wide and beckoned Joel in. "It'll make Edwin's day," I said to Michael, and we exchanged smiles at the shouts of glee that erupted from the kitchen. It was a blustery morning, and bright bursts of sunshine were interspersed with shade from the scudding clouds. I decided to let the boys play for half an hour in the day nursery, and if Alex hadn't arrived by then, I would take them down to the beach for a run around on the sand. They always seemed particularly full of energy on windy days. I tried not to clock watch, but I heard the crunch of Alex's car while the boys were absorbed in their game, and I met him at the door. His expression was expectant.
"Laura, hi. Is Ruth?"
I chewed my lip. "She went out. I'm sorry. She left about 20 minutes ago. Said she'd be an hour or two." He looked so crestfallen, I stepped back without thinking. "Do you want to come in?" We walked through to the kitchen.
"Do you know where she went?"
he asked, his eyes roaming over the unwashed breakfast dishes, the paintings on the fridge, the wall calendar. I picked up his sunglasses from the windowsill. "You left these at the picnic." I handed them to him. "She's gone to visit a baby in the village."
"Oh."
He opened the arms of the sunglasses, closed them again.
"Right."
He thought for a moment, then glanced at me.
"What are you and Edwin up to for the next hour?"
"We were going to go down to the beach, get the wind in our hair, you know. Would you like to come?"
"Oh, I meant, would I be in your way if I stayed here to wait?"
"Oh, right. No, of course not."
"But the beach does sound good,"
he said. And then he was smiling, and there must have been a break in the clouds, because the kitchen was suddenly flooded with sunshine. Edwin and Joel hurtled in.
"Uncle Alex, look, Joel's here."
"Excellent," Alex said. "I was hoping for two smart boys to show me where the blackberries grow on the way to the beach."
Within minutes, I had locked up, and we were heading toward the back gate.
"No climbing this time, Edwin,"
Alex called out. And Edwin shook his head vigorously as he ran ahead with Joel.
"No way!"
We paused at the folly, craning our necks to peer at the cannon jutting out from the top of the tower.
"Can we go up?"
Joel asked, batting his long lashes at me. I looked at Alex, and he looked at Edwin.
"Do you want to, Edwin?"
Alex asked, and Edwin nodded, skipping ahead into the stone circle and wrestling to turn the heavy iron handle on the door of the tower. Alex suggested that I climb the spiral staircase first, with Edwin and Joel following, and he would come last to catch them if they fell. The steps were perforated iron, and our footsteps clanked and echoed as we climbed. It can't have been more than 6 meters high, but my heart pounded as we wound our way up. The wind whipped my breath away as I emerged onto the platform, and I was immensely thankful for the stone parapet that encircled the small space. There was a central stone dais decorated with carved sea serpents, and on top of it, a large sundial, and a contraption with a glass lens, and the black cannon I had glimpsed from down below. The barrel of the cannon pointed out toward the sea, and the four of us shuffled around in an arc between the dais and the parapet, so that Alex could show us where the gunpowder went and how the sun shone through the lens onto the powder at the critical moment. Joel was entranced, but Edwin spent more time peering down at the cliff top below.
"Look for Theo,"
he said suddenly, and Alex's smile plummeted.
"Hey, let's go down again, carefully, and see if there are any blackberries left," Alex said.
Back on the ground, the boys went to search in the bushes, squealing when they found each blackberry, stuffing them into their mouths as if they hadn't been fed for days. I gave Alex an inquiring look.
"This is where they were when Theo fell," he said quietly. "Ruth helped Theo up first to see the cannon. Then she brought him down and strapped him into the double stroller before getting Edwin out and taking him up. It's something they did every week. But Ruth couldn't manage the staircase with both of them. It's too dangerous."
I stared at him, wide-eyed. I wanted to tell him to stop, to change the subject. But I also wanted to hear. I needed to know.
"Theo must have unstrapped himself. Ruth was at the top with Edwin when she spotted him toddling toward the edge of the cliff."
I pressed my fingers over my mouth. Alex's gaze was distant.
"They think he was aiming for the steps, but missed his footing. He fell and hit his head. No other major injuries, remarkably. But he never woke up."
Tears brimmed in his eyes. "It's awful," I said. A surge of nausea made me turn away and shuffle to the stone wall, where I sat with my head hanging. Alex went to help